Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the show, whether you're watching live or listening on the podcast. We've got a very, very important show today, which is a very damning insight into the realities of modern Britain. The mass sackings of P&O workers is shocking, but in many ways not surprising. Exposes the terrible fire and rehire framework which exists in Britain. The way that the law is systematically rigged against working people, the fact that a multinational company can behave like this. So you've seen these mass sackings of hundreds of people, some by video link. There's various reports of, for example, people being told on video link, handcuffs being used, people being forcibly taken off, marched off the ships, and reportedly Eastern European labour being used with £2.60 an hour or even less. It's an absolute shocker. And as I've said, it does reveal quite a lot about the state of modern Britain. Now, let's just go straight now to talk to Mick Lynch, who is the General Secretary of the RMT, which is the trade union which represents these P&O workers. Good to see you, Mick. How are you doing?
All right, yeah, considering. Been a busy week.
I can imagine, yeah. Can you just talk us through what happened and how is it possible? Because a lot of people, maybe naively, will just find this so astonishing that this is in any way legally possible. So just tell us the basics.
Yeah, it's a bit complex. So if you have international voyages, so ferries to France, Holland and the Republic of Ireland are governed by international law. So you can, if you choose as an employer, use overseas labour. So we've got a mixture, or there is a mixture of largely Russian officers, Ukrainian ratings, Filipino ratings, Indonesian and Indian ratings. That's the crew that can work all around the world on British flagged or foreign flagged vessels. Traditionally, and up until now, ferries going from UK waters. So we have ferries all around the Scottish Islands, up to the Shetlands, over to Ireland, over to Holland and France and Belgium and all the rest of it. Those have traditionally been crewed by UK and European crews, obviously working from those countries back and forth. We have had encroachment of foreign labour being used at cut price discount rates. Now, we've got no beef with people from overseas trying to make a living, but we've got to stop the race to the bottom. So what P&O have done, using COVID as a smokescreen and saying that they've lost X amount of pound, and we know that businesses have struggled. We're not unreal in our approach. But using COVID as a smokescreen, they've decided to sack their entire workforce. And that goes from the captains, the masters of the vessels, who have special powers under law, maritime law, all the way down to people working in the canteens, the engineers and the people on deck that you see tying up and all the rest of it and marshalling the lorries and the cars. Every single person has been dismissed. And what they aim to do is replace them entirely with cut price foreign labour. They may not all be foreign to start with from overseas, but they'll work their way through so that they end up with the cheapest labour they can get. And traditionally, they brought people over from Latvia, Lithuania. And if you go on a cruise liner, which is obviously international, I'm not sure that's your bag, Owen, but if you were to go on a cruise, you would the masters of the vessels, the officers, would usually be European or American or Russian. And then everybody underneath that, and it is like an upstairs downstairs relationship, would be from abroad. And the further abroad they're from, i.e. the Far East or India, the cheaper they will be. And they will be on those vessels for up to 3 months or longer at a time. Now, that's more usual on the high seas when you're going international on the big tankers and on the cargo ships. But on local waters, which can be international, it's traditionally been the indigenous, if you like, labour from the countries involved. So they've used the weakest employment laws in Europe, which is what we've got, to facilitate this sacking. But even under our weak laws, you're supposed to, or obliged to under law, consult the unions. So once it's a redundancy and a reorganisation of over 20 staff at a single location, which this obviously involves, is 800 at several locations, you have to go into to a statutory consultation process with the unions. And the idea is that maybe you can work out a deal, you can work out some amendments, and reach, hopefully, an understanding about how that company could be restructured or reorganised to protect the staff and protect the company, if you like, if you want to put it that way. The punishments for that are very weak. You only get a financial settlement, which will be a number of weeks' wages, at a tribunal. So if you're in a very small company, a local business, they may make some mistakes in what they're doing. And if they do that, they'll get punished financially. A company like P&O is a mega company. It's been around for 180 years. It runs cruise ships, freight vessels and ferries. And it's backed up by one of the richest families in the world, a set of oligarchs from Dubai, the Sultan of Dubai and the Dubai royal family. And they're slowly taking over all of the logistics on the planet, basically. They're buying ferries and ports and super terminals all over the world so that they can diversify out of the oil industry, which they've obviously got control of in the Middle East traditionally. So it's an absolute outrage. These people have conspired against their members. They told the government on Wednesday night that they were going to commit this illegal act, and the government did nothing about it. They didn't even object to it. They just said, oh, we note the position, and sent a memo around the Department for Transport informing themselves that it was happening and informing other departments, government departments, that it was going to happen, and did nothing to say to this company, if you do that, we are going to prosecute you, which could end up with the directors facing criminal sanctions. What they have to do now is train this new set of crew, replacement labour, on vessels they've never seen, on the busiest highways in the world, business seaways in the world. The Channel is the busiest seaway anywhere on the planet. And they're going to take to the seas next week, they hope, with a completely new set of crew that we believe are untrained, and leave our people on the dole. Now, we've got to correct that. We're calling for government intervention. In the long term, in the medium term, we want our employment laws strengthened. This is 40 years of diluting employment protection in Britain. It's not just about strike ballots, which you often hear the RMT complain about. We've got impossibly difficult industrial relations laws. But it's also about the day-to-day protection of individual workers and collections of workers having extremely weak employment labour. They could not do this in France, and they couldn't do it in Holland. They couldn't do it anywhere in Europe and anywhere in the advanced economies, probably, because the employment laws are better. So that's it in a nutshell. And we've launched our campaign. We're looking for everyone to get involved. We'll be outside DP World again tomorrow, which is in Belgravia, fittingly enough. And we'll be outside Parliament because Labour is going to bring an emergency debate tomorrow afternoon. And we're hoping that we can make this government intervene. We want them to seize the vessels and impound those vessels and build a solution where we can get our people back on board in their rightful place, earning their living.
I'm not a cruise ship kind of guy, but I did actually, as a kid, take P&O ferries.
Trainer more like, bro.
There's nothing wrong with it. I'm not judging people who go on cruises, but it's very much wrapped up in the childhood of people like myself. We'd go to France, we'd get on the P&O ferry. Mm. Occasionally felt a bit seasick as a child. I mean, I mentioned fire and rehire, but this isn't actually fire and rehire. This is just fire. This is just
fire and rehire someone else. Yeah.
Exactly. On inferior terms and conditions. Mm. I mean, this is, a lot of people look at this. You say, you know, basically these rich oligarchs, Dubai and all the rest of it. I mean, this is gangster capitalism, isn't it?
Absolutely. They're saying that we're not worried about the law. They will get a sanction. There's no doubt about it. Everyone is accepting they're breaking the law. But the sanctions are so weak, it's not worth them worrying about. For them, it's like getting a parking ticket up the West End. You know, they might get a 50 quid fine. So if our members win the full amount that they could win in a tribunal that could take a year or more to bring to fruition, the maximum they could win is 13 weeks' wages. That's the maximum of the punishment for the individual member bringing that case. And we'll support them in that. But that's too late. We need instant reaction. We need an instant response from the government, from all the politicians, and from the public who've got to show their dismay and have got to boycott P&O in the meantime. If they reopen next week or the week after and start running ferries at discount prices, we're going to ask for the public coming into the holiday season at Easter and through the summer to boycott this company and go onto our other ferries where we have got terms and conditions negotiated. So we've got Stena and DFDS who are running on similar routes. And those people are undermined as well, because the first thing that I know that Stena and DFDS and others are going to say is, how can I run my business on a cost footing that is completely different to P&O? Because they're still paying agreed wages, paying pension contributions, sick pay, and all the things you might expect of a decent company. And so it will be a race to the bottom. But my message to every British worker is that this undermines you. Whether you're working for a small firm, a medium firm, or a super conglomerate, a global, you are undermined by this, because it will give confidence to HR directors and HR lawyers that if they can get away with this and P&O gets up and running, their firms could do something similar. And they'll start thinking, well, why am I paying all this holiday pay? Why don't I just put people on the statutory minimum? You don't have to go abroad to get cheap labour. You just put people on the national minimum wage. You have no entitlement to sick pay, and you have no entitlement to anything except statutory holidays. And all the things that have been negotiated are the norms, are undermined by this gangster capitalism.
I mean, if the government doesn't step in, I mean, the message surely is this could happen to any British workers. I mean, in terms of just concrete demands, there have been some calling for nationalisation of P&O. So I'm just wondering, what's your thoughts on that, for example, as a demand?
Well, if you take the railway, if when a railway company, a train operating company, an LNER, for instance, is one on the East Coast, goes bust and can't continue, the government steps in and ensures that that railway runs, and it's called the operator of last resort. We could have a scenario here where the government does become the operator of last resort, because this company, it's not just about us going on our holidays. They import and export 15% of our trade through those docks. So these are very heavy industrial docks, moving machinery, food, supplies, technology, whatever you want to name, through those docks at Dover, Hull, up in Scotland, over to Larne, in Ireland, and all the rest of it. So they're a vital part of the economy, not just for our, you know, towing your caravan over to France. So in terms of logistics and maintaining our status as a merchant nation and as having a merchant marine, the government ought to do something, and Tories ought to be looking at it especially. We've got the, you know, what we call the white ensign, the red ensign on the back of some of these vessels, which is the British Merchant Marine. And we've gone from having over 100,000 merchant seafarers in this country down to about 6,000 or 7,000. And the ports are the element, the main element of that. The ferries are the main element of what's going on. So we need an intervention, and we need to preserve our status as a trading nation and as a merchant marine as well. And we won't have it otherwise. It will be all conducted by overseas crews with overseas owners.
Just a couple of other things, or just kind of lastly, really. I mean, in terms of what members of the public can do, we're talking about a boycott, which is obviously very important. People need to boycott P&O ferries. But what the kind of general, the broader demands that the labour movement, the public need to focus on? Because as you said, this is, I mean, what even though they've actually broken the law here, so you could say, well, actually, the law already forbids this. But as you say, the sanctions are so weak, they basically just factor that in in their cost benefit analysis. So what are the kind of main demands, and what this says in terms of the general struggle for workers' rights in Britain? Well, we have some of the most, let's be honest, weakest workers' rights in the Western world.
The sanctions are weak for the individual member. So one of my members taking this tribunal case could get a maximum of 13 weeks. But the sanctions that are potentially available against the directors of P&O can be very severe. They can be prison sentences. But the prosecuting authority in that, I believe, is the what used to be called the Inland Revenue, the HMRC. And that's because the directors will have so flagrantly breached the regulations that will be a criminal act. And Kwasi Kwarteng has written to me on Saturday morning, actually, saying that he's giving P&O until Tuesday evening to explain what they've done. Otherwise, he's going to give it to the prosecutors. So he needs to do that to call them to task. The government, we need to support the demand that the government intervene. Now, they can intervene in a number of ways. They can order the Maritime and Coastal Authority to intervene and hold those vessels in port until this is sorted out. And if necessary, I believe that we should take these companies into public ownership. Some of these seafaring routes used to be in public ownership. Sea Link used to run a lot of these routes under the British Railways. They were state owned, and we didn't have these kind of problems, and people could expect decent conditions. So those are the immediate things that can happen. And of course, the Scottish Government and the Northern Ireland Assembly also have powers, because there is a domestic route between Scotland, Cairn Ryan in Scotland, and Larne in County Antrim, where they can make an intervention. So there are three out of the four nations that are involved in this that can get directly involved as political entities. And the weird thing is, I mean, I never thought I'd say this, we've got support from the Democratic Unionist Party. I believe that Sinn Féin is supporting us in up north, in the north of Ireland as well. We've had support from the SNP, we've had support from Labour, and we've had support from Tory politicians. The Tory chair of the Transport Select Committee is supporting us, demanding government intervention on Monday. Keir Starmer came on a call with us and the sacked port workers on the other day, on Friday. And so we've got a lot of support across the political spectrum, and we've got to turn that into a concrete outcome. In the immediate term, I've told Keir Starmer, direct to his face the other day, he has to take this as an open goal for the Labour Party and the Labour movement, and demonstrate to what the former Red Wall and now Blue Wall that he's on the side of workers. Because outsourcing, and this is a form of outsourcing, because they've created a company, International Ferry Management, to control these the crewing of these vessels. That outsourcing is a plague on working class communities, driving down wages, driving down to conditions, stripping out pensions, stripping out sick pay. And we need a set of minimal standards and negotiating rights for trade unions that can be enforced as part of the Labour Party's programme at the next election. And that will stabilise many working class communities and working class people, so that they can have the right to trade union representation and the right to job security at a set of standards that we used to have going back to the 60s, 70s and 80s, when this could not have happened. And we would have been allowed to take secondary action and blockade those ports, which is what we need to do, really.
And if there's one thing Keir Starmer will never do, is miss an open goal. I think that really sums up his...
Well, let's see.
Courageous, truth to power leadership that runs through the core of everything he does.
I really believe
I'm
that
sorry, so I'm being bitchy, I'm sorry.
Is at the heart of what's wrong in working class communities at the moment. There's a lot of other things, but the one thing that unites people of all descriptions, and I obviously live in the southeast in London, mm-hmm. and I see our outsourced cleaners in transport, mm-hmm. in the health service, in all of the public services. The super exploitation is taking place mm-hmm. through third party companies. And it lies heaviest on the traditional working class communities, which are a mixture of traditional white working class people, if you want to put it that way, but also migrant labour and people new to the country that have come from all sorts of backgrounds in the last 15, 20 years since the so-called liberalisation of economies. And that will unite them. If we had sectoral negotiation, I know it's a bit technical, but if we had minimum standards for cleaners and catering workers and supply workers, and the logistics supply chain, all these delivery people that we're all reliant on every day, if they had a set of standards and union bargaining and national negotiating councils, this country would be entirely different, because workers would have some self-respect and people would start to believe again in collective power, which is what they've lost, because they've all become atomized and individuals at work. And then when they bring it home from work, everyone feels there's nothing they can do. And the best thing you can do is look for another job. And that's not the way forward. Starmer's got to get behind that. You don't have to be a left-winger to believe in that.
No, well, probably for the best, that, isn't it? But let's see how he does. Let's see how he does. But I'm glad you're keeping his feet to the fire. Mick, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. So comprehensive. Very, very clear. I think anyone who is mystified about exactly what's going on is very clear about it, and also what needs to happen. And I'm sure people will be boycotting PNO en masse. But Mick, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, and solidarity in the days
you.
And weeks.
Have a great show.
Cheers, buddy. Take care yourself.
I'll have a cup of tea. I'll see you later.
Yeah, you deserve a cup of tea. You've earned it. Have a good cuppa.
Right.
See you in a bit. See ya. Great stuff there from Mick. Before we talk to our next brilliant guest, Ellie Mayer-Hagan, let's just have a little look. So here's a demonstration. Let's have a look at this PNO demonstration. Workers are taking to the streets in various parts of the country.
Broken the law on consultation.
if you're listening to the podcast, that was probably just a bizarre sound of essentially it sounded like some sort of massive fan going off. It was actually just some workers marching under the banner of the RMT. Now, even if you're not watching the video, you'll be able to make out what happened here when the Conservative MP Natalie Elphick, who's the Conservative MP for Dover, decided to rock up to a demonstration of P&O workers. She did not get the warmest response.
Fire, 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 fire. You voted for fire and rehire. You voted for fire and rehire. You voted for fire and rehire. Shame on you, man. Shame on you. 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 Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
I will be marching for the jobs in Dover, for the people of Dover, and for the disgusting behaviour of P&O and Digital World.
The steel workers
are
coal miners, shipbuilders,
everybody. I am here for the people of Dover.
No, you're not. You're here.
Say what you want about British culture, but I think we've got heckling down to a T. Natalie Elphick was not best pleased there, but I mean, that was deserved. Heckling can be more than deserved, and I think that was pretty justified, given, as the hecklers pointed out, Natalie Elphick voted for fire and rehire, and the sorts of, well, repeated attacks on workers' rights and trade union rights that have happened under the Conservative government that, of course, she is an MP for. Now, let's just as well, before we talk to Ellie, just listen to what Andy Burnham, who is, of course, the Greater Manchester Labour mayor. Let's see what he had to say in an interview.
Act on this. What else will they let go afterwards?
Just one more. How do you think that the AC scheme is going to work?
How do you think any of the workers are going to start on that? Or it should be boycotted by everybody. People's boycott working for this company while this is ongoing. And I would say to the public, they should boycott travelling with this company. Stand firm with these workers. You know, their fight is everybody's fight here. I never want to see another government minister use the phrase build back better if they just let this happen, because it will mean absolutely nothing at all. What we need is intervention from the top today to sort this out. And as I say, if the company won't respond, then I would say to the government, you should consider nationalising this company.
So that's interesting. A mainstream politician there calling for the nationalisation of P&O. So it's worth seeing whether or not that takes off. That's bringing in Ellie, but as ever, if you're watching live, do click on the YouTube link, press like and subscribe. If you're listening to the podcast, obviously, great. Leave a review. Spread the word there. And leave a comment as well if you're watching after the live show. Leave a comment on YouTube. All good for the algorithm. I do read through the comments, most of them. The more fiery end of the comments. I read them all. Diligent. Also, you can support us on patreon.com/OwenJones84. We're going to work on a documentary imminently. And that will be decided by people on Patreon. All our documentaries were decided by your suggestions. You can support the show on Super Chat on YouTube as well. Thanks already to Tad Campwell, John McKenzie, and David Barata. I'll go through some of their questions actually with Ellie in a minute. Let's bring her in. Let's bring in Ellie. Ellie May Hagen, the director the director of class. I'll read out the super chats at the end as well to thank everyone, because I haven't always remembered and I get told off. Ellie, great to see you.
Hello.
The reason Ellie's looking so fresh, which I know is what everyone's thinking, is Ellie does these ice cold swims first thing in the morning, which to me sound horrific.
Well, I actually didn't go today because I woke up with a cold. So I actually think I look really rough. Not fresh.
You look great. You go for a cold swim. Of course, it's just a cold. It's not COVID. No, it's just a cold, Ellie.
Well, fortunately, I had COVID quite recently, so I think I'll be okay for a couple of months on the COVID.
You smashed
front.
It. Yeah. Ellie is one of my dearest friends, but I haven't actually seen her in the flesh for a while. We now solely communicate through the medium of my show.
Yeah.
So this is why we're having a little catch up. Sorry, just because.
Did you have a good night last night?
Great, thanks, Ellie. Let's just move on, shall we? Now, Ellie, okay, let's. We just obviously you saw there some of the footage. A Tory MP hasn't gone down well. What do you think? You're that. For those who don't know, Ellie is a writer, but also the director of Class, the think tank, which puts a lot of these things in perspective and argues for sorts of policies and changes to the economic model that we need. What does this say about our economic model? Let's just do that.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Well, we need a new economic system. We need to create a new one because the one that we currently have prioritizes the interests of a very tiny, tiny, tiny group of people over the interests of the vast majority. And, you know, in this case, so I can't say too much about this because we're releasing this report next week, but we've done a report with the Autonomy, the think tank, a joint report on job insecurity. And what we've found is basically since 2005, in every single sector, no matter how senior you are in your job, you've seen an increase of job insecurity year on year. The only exception to that is 2021, and that's because the pandemic meant that 2020 was so exceptionally insecure for workers that it sort of created this false decrease. But if you take that year out of it, then you can see a year-on-year increase of every single sector. So what we're actually seeing, and we've said this in some of our other reports, is like, and it's interesting to me, I suppose there's something a little full circle about the fact that these are ferry workers who obviously arrive in docks every day. Because what we're actually seeing is a kind of return to the sort of Victorian dock work way of working, which is that you're permanently on call to go to work. And if you're not needed, you just don't get called and tough. You just have to figure out how to make ends meet until you get some work. That is the sort of model that like millions and millions of people are now working in. And a big contribute towards that is fire and rehire, because it allows companies to break people's contracts where they might have secure employment and replace them with contracts that might be more insecure. And actually, at Class, we don't call for the abolishment of 0 hours contracts, because we think if you abolish 0 hours contracts, they'll be replaced with tiny hours contracts. So where you get like 4 hours a week, you know, that's your contract. So we actually prefer a model like, believe it or not, McDonald's do, where after about 3 months or 6 months, maybe, you're given the opportunity as a worker to negotiate your contracted hours based on what you normally work, rather than being given a set contract that could be a tiny hours or a 0 hours contract. Anyway, I'm getting into the...
Because the problem at the moment, I suppose, with 0 hour contracts at the moment is... Because they're often shown as, oh, well, actually flexible working works for some people. But the problem is that it's flexibility on the terms of the employer rather than the employee. So what you're trying to talk about actually is you, because flexible working arrangements work for lots of people, but it would be on the terms of workers rather than just dictated by bosses' needs.
Yeah, so flexible working does work for some people. It works for a very small amount of people who are already in like very senior positions. Because we did find that people at management level are becoming more insecure than they used to be. And, you know, for some of them, being a contracted worker will have advantages. Like, you know, they can, perhaps they can work the hours that they want to work, or they can take time off, but that relies on having a very high salary. so that you can put money aside. And that isn't, for most people, that's not the experience of 0 hours contracts. For most people, it comes with a low salary. So that creates exactly the situation that you're talking about, which is, you know, if you need the money, you immediately don't have flexibility as a worker, because you just have to take what you're given because you need the money. And you have to really go quite high up the salary brackets until you kind of, you're in a position where you don't need the money. You know, and we hear this all the time. We interview people all the time about this stuff. And, you know, we hear, you know, like one common thing, particularly amongst like people working in hospitality, is just like sexual harassment in the workplace, either from like customers or colleagues or bosses. They just have to keep quiet about because they know that they're just going to lose their hours, you know, like going above and beyond what your job says to do, because you feel like you need to compete with other people for the hours, you know, things like that. So it really just makes you this stuff. The reality for most people is that it makes you totally at the whim of what your bosses want to do, often having to prove yourself in terms of like why they should give you the hours as opposed to somebody else in some sectors. So yeah, it's like this, I see this, what's happened with P&O, as like a very extreme example of a wider pattern. And I think the main difference between P&O and other countries that have used fire and rehire or have been accused by unions of fire and rehire, so I'll just name a few. Weetabix, Asda, British Gas, British Airways. The main difference between this one and them is that this one is just getting rid of the employees altogether, because normally when you fire and rehire, you fire them and then you rehire the same people. Whereas this one is getting rid of the employees altogether and replacing them with other people. Agency workers that I presume P&O must think that they can exploit more easily. And that also speaks to those workers not having rights and those workers needing rights. And really there being a sort of duty for us to support both groups of workers coming together to have shared rights and equality so that this can never happen again. Yeah, so I see it as like an extreme example of a pattern that's been building for a long time.
Something we need to engage with, partly because people are putting the comments, but it has been part of the discussion, is the B word, Brexit. So Tad Campbell says, has leaving the EU weakened the overall rights of UK workers? John McKenzie, why did the RMT encourage their members to vote for Brexit? This is the end result. There's no European staff were fired, just British staff. Yeah, I think this is a bit unpicking a bit because... I mean, the RMT took a democratic decision, whether we like it or not, to support Brexit. Me and Ellie both campaigned for Remain. But I think I'm worried about a kind of Brexit culture war creeping into this, because obviously there needs to be a broad coalition of people, whether they voted Remain or Leave, to tackle the scandalous lack of workers' rights. A lot. Part of the reason Leave won was many ex-industrial communities where insecure working patterns have become so dominant, that fed into a lot of disillusionment, that fed into the Brexit vote. I mean, one thing that I remember I argued in the referendum campaign, I remember saying on Question Time, was the danger was that Brexit would be used kind of as an ideological project afterwards, when we abandon the minimum standards to kind of have a race to the bottom to compete with the EU on scrapping workers' rights. But it isn't really fair to say, is it, that this is Brexit specific, is it? I mean, this could have happened. I mean, these sorts of practices happened in this country before we left the European Union. It's not, I suppose the argument would be instead that the Brexiteers said, some of them, we're going to have better workers' rights now. And that hasn't happened. I suppose that's a better critique. What do you think? Sorry, I've said a lot there.
Yeah, I think like, basically, I presume that your viewers / listeners want to create a situation where this doesn't happen anymore. And I would say that saying let's rejoin the EU, I mean, for example, not maybe they think the moment has passed or whatever, but like, let's hypothetically say that's what your viewers were saying when they were criticizing RMT's decision to back a Leave vote, I would say that is like barking up the wrong tree, and it's actually not going to help the situation. It's true to say that there are certain laws that the certain laws around workers' rights that the EU has that exist at an EU-wide level, that if you're a member of the EU, that you have to abide by. So, in like an example of this is like so holiday pay, maternity, holiday leave, maternity leave, and like the, what is called the working time directive, which is that you can't work any more than 48 hours a week, but you can opt out of that as well. So it's true to say that there are some things that that like are at, set at an EU-wide level, but this practice of fire and rehire, and actually like the majority of the erosion of workers' rights that we've seen in this country over the last 5 years, have got nothing to do with the EU. In fact, in 2015, David Cameron was trying to negotiate with the EU so that we could have more autonomy over our of what we do in this country. We could opt out of certain EU stuff, basically, so that he could weaken workers' rights. And we've got to remember that before we left the EU, David Cameron, when he was prime minister, his government introduced the Trade Union Act, mm-hmm. which was a massive crackdown on trade unions, and introduced lots and lots of new laws that basically make it really hard to go on strike, and that sort of make unions have to spend money on pointless administrative things, kind of drain unions of money, basically, and also make it harder for unions to be involved with politics with a big P. And that was, you know, that was irrelevant to whether we were in the EU or not, you know. So, and I think the other thing as well is that fire and rehire, like unions are reporting that fire and rehire has seen an increase over the last sort of like 8-10 years, which is obviously predates us leaving the EU. So I think if your aim is to protect workers' rights and to end the practice of fire and rehire, like imagining that we will do that by rejoining the EU, I just think you'll be very disappointed if we ever did join rejoin the EU, because you will find very quickly that it doesn't do that. Because actually, what you actually need is, yes, you need a government that recognizes the importance of trade unions and reflects that in its laws, but you also need trade union power. You need strong memberships. You need like trade unions need the freedom to be able to access workplaces and to organize. You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that union density has fallen, inequality has just exploded across the Western world. So, you know, I think like saying that if we stopped Brexit, that like this would stop all this stuff happening, I feel like that is a very tempting thing to think, because that seems sort of simple and maybe like easier, but it's not the right answer. I think that there's lots of ways that unions can intervene on this stuff. There's like public mm-hmm. pressure. There's things like strategic legislation, which is where, you know, you take a case to court. So an example of this is the GMB Uber case, where they took Uber to court and then they mm-hmm. won the right for their drivers to be seen as employees. Mm-hmm. Or you organize in workplaces. This is all in our new report coming out next week. But yeah, there's a reason why in our recommendations we don't say rejoining the EU, is because it is a bit of a red herring. I'm not saying the EU has no influence over improving workers' rights, because it clearly does, but it's just not the main show in town. And seeing it that way just won't get you to where you want to be.
Tom Clark is a journalist who's also the contributing editor at Prospect, the magazine, and he said in 1981, Reagan set the neoliberal tide in motion with the mass sacking of air traffic controllers. For those who don't know, the air traffic controllers were on strike in 1981, and literally they just replaced them all en masse. In 2022, P&O is riding to new extremes, and I think a point where it will start to unravel. I don't know. I mean, maybe us on the left, like when the financial crash happened, we were like, see? Neoliberalism itself had evidently been exposed to what it is. It's, how can neoliberalism possibly recover from this one? And then we had years of slash and burn cuts and the public sector being demonized as somehow being responsible for the mess that we're in. So I don't want to be, because we do this a lot sometimes, we're like, well, this is a big moment. Everyone will suddenly see neoliberalism for what it is. And actually, you know, polling wise, neoliberalism doesn't have mass buy-in in terms of enthusiastic support. It often has acquiescence or resignation, which are different. But what do you think? I mean, surely this, people will look at this and go, you know, because the people ask questions, don't they, about something like this. They don't just look at this and think this is terrible in its own right. They think, what kind of system could allow this to happen? What sort of country am I living in where this is possible? Those are the kind of profound questions people ask. So what do you think? I mean, is this a real moment where people might begin to, as I said, not break their enthusiasm, which I don't think exists for neoliberalism, but their resignation or their acquiescence? What do you think? Is this a big, big moment?
Well, I'm going to plug my book. So I'm writing a book called about, well, I say called, I haven't come up with a title yet, but it's basically about the sort of a modern history of the centre ground. So looking at how the centre ground was formed and how it collapsed. My argument is that it collapsed as a result of the financial crisis. So I actually did spend the last 2 days sitting in the British Library reading microfilm, which is like when you're in, when you like, you probably use it for your degree, Owen, but like when you're, when you watch those kind of murder mystery films and there's like a detective who's like reading old newspaper headlines on those screens, like that's what microfilm is. All based around September 2020. So I read all of the articles that were written in September 2020 in the Times and the Guardian. And yeah, but what I found then was that, yeah, people were, there was a kind of sense of like, can capitalism survive this, basically? And there was a very funny interview with Ken Livingstone where he was like, alas, I think capitalism might survive, which now seems like very quaint. And what I noticed, like when I was doing this research, is that there was definitely this sense of something has sort of unraveled, something that we thought was certain and sure, and something that we all accepted as being the way things are. All of that has unraveled in a matter of days. And people were asking what's next and what does this mean and what's gonna come from this. But all of the people who were in power, who had the ability to create whatever came next, were very attached to the existing system. And in fact, were so they'd drunk the Kool-Aid of that system to such an extent that they couldn't actually conceive of what an alternative system looked like. They nationalized the banks because they had to, but they didn't like it. And they didn't really see that as a gateway into doing something different. They just saw it as a temporary, uncomfortable thing that they would have to do before they went back to normal. And there were left voices. So like people like Michael Meacher, you know, people like John McDonnell, they were... like, and then the sort of grouplets like the Socialist Party, the Socialist Worker Party, you know, that kind of stuff. They were putting out, you know, these sort of left critiques or these like ideas for alternatives. But they were so marginalized, you know, like in the research I did, Michael Meacher got a letter in The Guardian and that was it. You know, he didn't get any coverage. They were so marginalized that it was like quite hard for them to get a look in. What do we learn from that we can apply to this? I think that we learn that people tend to pick up the ideas that are lying around. You know, you've said that before, the Milton Friedman quote, in a crisis, people just pick up the ideas that are lying around.
And then the impossible can become the inevitable.
Yeah, exactly.
He says it depends on a crisis, but he says it depends on the ideas lying around. And the problem with 2008 was the left didn't have a clear, coherent alternative. So you had a crisis of capitalism, but you had an empty cupboard for the left, which has changed now. But you had huge amounts of neoliberal ideas, which could then be appropriated. And the balance of power in society meant that obviously the elites could use that crisis as another power grab.
Oh, right. My husband has just turned up with a notepad and said, I said September 2020 instead of 2008. I meant 2008.
Oh, I like it. Is he just sitting there, just next to you?
No, he was in the other room, and I think he must be listening to it in the other room.
Bless.
That's it. Ladies, get you a man that watches all your appearances on The Owen Jones Show.
Just checks your dates.
Think he's watching it for you, not me. What was I saying? And I think that has changed now. Like, that was one thing that was very heartening, was I was just like, God, there really wasn't a left in 2008. It really was just Michael Meacher and John McDonnell and a bit of Ken Livingstone thrown in for good measure. And now we do have a bit more of a left sort of ecosystem in the media. And I think there is a kind of renewed sense of that things need to change. I think, you know, you can see with the trade unions seem to be getting more militant. You know, there's like, there's the kind of climate movement of like young people, Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of these different sort of radical elements coming together. And I think our role as a sort of collective is to imagine something different and to say kind of what we're for and what our world looks like, not just with this, but with a whole host of other things that we're facing.
So finally, just to kind of wrap up, where do we go from here? What do you think the kind of key demands are that people should be focusing on in the here and now?
Well, I mean, I think what Mick said is really important, that like basically there has to be some kind of sanction, doesn't there, that makes it not worth doing. Like, you know, that's the problem here, is that the sanctions that DP World are going to face are not severe enough to stop them from doing it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how much sort of support there is for nationalisation. So Andy Burnham just called for it. But so did Ian Dale, who actually, he's a right-wing radio presenter who actually ran as a Conservative MP. I mean, their reasons for calling for it are very different. I think Ian Dale's is more around the fact that, like, on that particular trading route, it's only P&O ferries that run it, so it's a bit like a natural monopoly. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think Andy Burnham, it's more about workers' rights. But I don't see why that shouldn't be on the table. I mean, they've behaved badly. Like, just take it away from them, you know. And I personally am of the mind that anything that's a kind of essential service should be, not necessarily like it should be nationalized, but it should be up for discussion that it gets nationalized. Any service that people have to use, but they don't get a choice about using, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of a tiny group of individuals making a profit out of that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of those cases. So personally, I would like to see nationalisation. I would like to see sort of criminal sanctions against the relevant people if it's been shown that that they have broken the law. And from what Mick says, it sounds like they have. And obviously, you know, a big strike fund for RMT workers and just full support for the union as well in this case. And, you know, in all cases when it comes to support the union, but I mean like RMT union in this case. So, yeah, I think those are the things that I would like to see. I don't think that we can just let companies get away with it. And I actually think that quite a lot of people, whatever politics they have, are just sick and tired of stories like this, where people just do like these sort of handful of people at the top, very small group of people, do awful things and screw over ordinary people who are just trying to make ends meet and then just get away with it. I mean, I feel like that's been the theme of the last sort of, I mean, well, for time in memoriam, but particularly that seems particularly bad in the last few years. And I think it's got to end. It's got to stop.
Got a bloody end, hasn't it? Hasn't it, Ellie?
Yeah.
Stop it right. Just stop it right now.
That's my demand. Stop it.
Just please, just don't stop being mean, capitalism. What are you like? With your little scamp. Ellie.
I'm giving you the finger under the table right now, just so you know.
Bit rude to come on my show and make profane sort of gestures at me, but take it in my stride. we should hang out soon. Maybe I should do my friend admin off air, because probably no one cares. But I'm glad you came on despite your cold, not COVID, colds. Do you remember those colds? We got colds back in the day. So
I hope so. I hope it's a cold. I'll be gutted.
You don't have COVID again. You had COVID about 3 weeks ago. I don't think you did. Although, I do know people actually got it over Christmas and then have got it more recently. My cousin was one of them. That'd be annoying.
I do know two people. But maybe, you never know, maybe it was a little Delta Omicron crossover. You never know.
Oh, yeah, because they've fused, haven't they? Yeah. I don't want to get COVID again. I think we've done COVID. Well, we haven't done COVID because COVID hasn't vanished, unfortunately. Ellie, that was great. You go and look after your cold. And I hope you feel better, and we will see you soon. But that was another tour de force.
Thanks.
It's all right. Go and have fun with your husband, who's strutting around with his notepad, making sure you don't get your dates wrong.
I mean, he does that even when I'm not, you know, he's always following me around with a notepad.
just random conversations. Whenever you get, if you're in the pub, just make a small factual error. He's just...
So we've got like an archive in the house of all of the sort of factual errors that I've made.
He's got like a whole filing cabinet. He just occasionally just goes through just all your little daily errors. Lots of love, Ellie. I will speak to you soon, but I hope you're doing better.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to both Ellie and Mick. They were both fantastic, as you'd expect. Always got a great caliber of guests in the show. I don't think we ever have any duds, but they were absolutely fantastic. Really summed it up. It's very important that we obviously cast a spotlight, not just on this particular issue, but the wider lessons about our economic system and our broken social order and the sort of demands that people need to make. So I think that's very important. I am going to go and do some writing now, so I'm going to leave you all to it. We've got obviously our show next week, but we've got documentaries, interviews in the pipeline. I'm not going to mention my book because no one wants to hear me say that again. Thanks to Tad Campwell, John McKenzie, and David Bowater. So everyone, whatever, I was going to say have a lovely Sunday, but most people don't watch or listen to this on the Sunday. So, here we go. Let's have a look at this. Nicola Wegler, please check your email for a booking inquiry for a feature film. Oh, sorry. I feel bad now. It's got to the point with my failure to respond to the emails that I get that people are now using Super Chat to press me, which is perfectly reasonable. Sorry, Nicole, I'll get onto that. I don't really have a choice now because you've supported the channel, which is very sweet of you. I'll get onto that. Okay, great. Cheers, everyone. That was fantastic stuff. Lots of love, and I will see you very soon.
Please support this channel for independent thought, discussion of the most important issues that we face.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.